It's 1984, and we're headed for a place called Arrakis. Dune. Desert planet. Why are we whispering?
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected.
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown. An incredible secret has been kept on this planet. And the unbelievable meet.
I see two great houses.
Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves.
And we have one sign the likes of which even God has never seen.
And skies are filled with fire.
The prophecy which will cleanse the universe and bring us out of darkness.
Where a young warrior is called upon to free his people. A world that holds creation's greatest treasure.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Random Rewatch. This is Mike, and this week we are doing Dune, a special episode celebrating the release of Dune Part 2 in theaters today. So I was really excited when it was announced that Denis Villeneuve was doing Dune. I was even more excited when it was announced that he was doing it as a two-parter, because this is a huge book. The novel's like 900 pages long, and as we will be talking about, it is impossible to put this book on film in a single 2 or 3 hour motion picture. In fact, when this novel was first being kicked around as something that someone wanted to make films out of, it was basically called unfilmable, and it has been called that over the years. Were they right? I don't know. But I think Denis Villeneuve has got it going pretty good based on the first part, and from what I'm seeing in critics on the second part. But this is not what we're talking about. Today, we are talking about David Lynch's 1984 adaptation, Dune. So a little bit of background. This was a novel written by Frank Herbert in 1965. Herbert was a journalist, and he was actually writing a story on sand dunes in Oregon and came up with the idea of a sci-fi novel set on a desert world, and spent a couple years writing this, and this novel has been considered to be one of the great sci-fi novels of all time, and I agree. I've read this book probably 5 or 6 times in its entirety over the last 30 years, and it's just such a great book. It's so in-depth. There's so many layers to it. A lot of people are trying to figure out what this story is actually about based on the first movie that Denis Villeneuve made, but you can't, because it only tells half the story. In fact, it doesn't even really tell half the story. Dune, the novel, is really a prologue to the story, which begins in the next book, which is Dune Messiah. And then there's Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Dune Heretic, and Chapter House Dune. The Book of Dune is really the setup for the ongoing story. And so half of that isn't even really giving you much of an idea as to what this whole book is about. David Lynch tried to get it down. He's not the first one. We're going to talk about that. He tried to get it down into one film. He struggled with it. He's not even happy with the result. But let's get going. How did this thing wind up on film in 1984? So there was a couple. Obviously, this book was so successful, people were looking to adapt this into film. Supposedly, the first pass at it was in 1971 by Roger Corman, the cheesy disaster flick guru. He was attached to it briefly. That didn't really go anywhere. And then a producer by the name of Arthur Jacobs in probably late 1971 wound up securing rights to it. Jacobs had produced a couple of Planet of the Apes films. He brought in a director named David Lean. David Lean had directed a couple of James Bond films in the 60s. And they worked on developing the film. There was, in the midst of this, there was a writer's strike, so things got delayed. And the way these rights were laid out, we've discussed this before, you have a certain time in order to get the film into production, or the rights revert back to the original rights holder, in this case, Frank Herbert. Unfortunately, Arthur Jacobs died in 1973. The film never wound up getting made. Later that year, a French consortium led by Jean-Paul Gibbon secured the rights to the film, and they brought in a man named Alejandro Jodorowsky to direct the film. They spent years in development on this. They spent millions of dollars on this. This is perhaps one of the most famous films that never got made. They've called this the most expensive movie that never got made. There's a documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune, which is solely about telling the story about the development of this film that never got made into a film. That's how interesting the story is. This cast of this was absolutely incredible. They had Orson Welles as the Baron Harkonnen, Mick Jagger as Fade Rautha, Salvador Dali as the Emperor, Gloria Swanson as the Reverend Mother. Jodorowsky's son was going to play Paul. They brought in H.R. Giger and Jean Giraud to do creative work in building, in doing set designs and, you know, pre-production art, concept drawings, all that stuff. In the middle of this production, there's a couple of problems. One is that Jodorowsky's vision was to have this be a 10 to 14 hour epic. He couldn't break it in less than that. And funding started to dry up. And then this little indie film called Star Wars came out in 1977. And two things happened there. One is it kind of sucked all the air out of the room in terms of this, you know, fantasy sci-fi sweeping epic. The other thing is that Star Wars cribs really heavily from Dune. Frank Herbert was really ticked off about this. There are so many elements in Star Wars, not only in the original film, throughout the saga, and when pressed on it, George Lucas has been very noncommittal about it, as he is, you know, kind of like, well, maybe I've read the book. But if you look at, you look closely at it, you know, there's so much. I mean, there's this evil galactic empire. You have this young man who is the chosen one, who is on a desert planet, whether you're talking about Paul or you're talking about Luke. The desert planet has these hooded natives, Fremen and sand people. You know, the Jedi and the Bene Gesserit share a lot of commonality. You have the Jedi mind trick. You have the Bene Gesserit voice, which can compel people to do what they want them to do. You have this, especially in the first trilogy of films, you have this kind of call back to an earlier time and an earlier war in Star Wars. It's the Clone Wars. Dune has a very similar thing in the Butlerian Jihad, which was an ancient war where men rose up against machines. By the way, I've seen this fan theory where the Matrix and the Unimatrix are actually the Butlerian Jihad. That's actually pretty interesting. So there's a lot of commonality in these stories. We know that Lucas cribbed heavily from Kurosawa. A lot of the story of the original, of the first movie, Star Wars, I call it Star Wars. People of my generation call it Star Wars. I know it's A New Hope, but when it was the only one, it was Star Wars, and that's the way it's impressed into my brain. But anyway, there's a lot of Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress in Star Wars. There's also apparently a lot of Dune in Star Wars. Eventually, Jodorowsky pulled out his, that whole project fell apart. It lost funding. Its investors lost confidence in it. The rights kicked around a little bit. In 1976, Dino De Laurentiis, who was a real powerhouse Hollywood producer, he managed to secure the rights. I think he secured the rights for three books. He brought in Ridley Scott. This is pre-Blade Runner. Ridley Scott took a pass at it and started working on developing it. He also brought in Geiger to kind of follow up on the work that he had done with Yudorovsky. It was at this point that Geiger came up with the design for the sandworms. It wasn't with Yudorovsky, it was with Ridley Scott. But eventually Ridley Scott got kind of bored with the project and there was a lot of conflicts. He was having a hard time breaking the story. He pulled out, he went off to do Blade Runner. Right around this time, David Lynch is this up-and-coming director. He's done Eraserhead in 1977 and The Elephant Man in 1980. Apparently that caught the eye of the De Laurentiis team. They brought him in to do direction on the film. He was, at this point, he was in the running to direct Return of the Jedi. It's kind of a weird situation with those films. So we're going to do, let me do just a little quick backtracking. So the Directors Guild of America, which is the union that represents directors, has a rule that if you have credits in the front of your movie, the director's name must be shown and it must be shown last. You can have no credits and that's fine, in which case the director's name is shown first at the end of the movie. But if you have a single credit that names a person who is involved with the film, then you have to have a director's credit. So Star Wars, A New Hope, famous, and none of the Star Wars films very famously have opening credits. They simply have the production logo, and then in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and then the film starts. The problem with Star Wars is that production logos are counted as credits. So since Lucasfilm at the time was George Lucas's production company, that counts as a credit. DGA didn't give him too hard of a time for a couple of reasons. One is because Star Wars was a really small film and nobody thought it was going to amount to anything. The second is because he was the director. You know, his name technically was in the front of the film. And so DGA kind of let it slide. Fast forward a couple of years, Empire Strikes Back come out. And Lucas does not direct it, or Rick Kirshner directs it. They follow the same formula. You know, Lucasfilm, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the name of the film. They don't put Kirshner's name in the front of the film. And this time, DGA takes a stand on it and sanctions the film, and they fine Kirshner $50,000. Lucas pays the fine and quits the Directors Guild. He leaves the DGA. So he went around, he was at the time shopping around for a Return of the Jedi for a non-DGA director. Lynch was in the running. He wound up landing on Richard Marquand, who directed that film. Same thing was continuing to happen, by the way, in the sequels, or sorry, in the prequels, which Lucas directed all of them. So DGA really didn't have anything to say because he's not a member of the DGA. And then by the time you got to the prequel trilogy, or the sequel trilogy, and The Force Awakens, Lucas was not involved in Lucasfilm anymore. So Lucasfilm became just a production logo and not a credit. And so technically, for those three films, there are no credits at the beginning of the film. Okay, so that's a quick primer on that whole situation. Anyway, David Lynch wound up not doing Return of the Jedi, mainly because he was worried he would not have enough control and that he would not get to make a statement in the film, which is probably true. Lucas, even though Lucas was a producer on the film, not the director, he had a very heavy hand in everything that went on in that film. That frees Lynch up, and Lynch joins the production of Dino De Laurentiis' Dune and starts working on scripts. He wrote multiple drafts. Some of them were hundreds of pages long. He finally settled on, I think the sixth draft was 135 pages, and they figured that was possibly shootable. Meanwhile, they're all out there building sets in Mexico. They're on sound stages. They're outside. This thing would swell out to over 80 sets, 1,700 members of the crew, and at one point, 20,000 extras. The budget on this film was $45 million, which in the early 80s was a ton of money. It was one of the most expensive films ever made up until that point. This thing was just absolutely huge. There were multiple cuts of this film, and we'll talk about that a little towards the end, but Lynch's, the original assembly cut was 4 hours. He cut it, he edited it down to about 3 hours, which was the cut that he was happy with, and it wound up, the studio and the De Laurentiis wound up cutting it down to 2 hours with some additions and some reshoots and some other stuff. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's how we wound up with the movie that we wound up with. The music was done by Toto, which is kind of strange. But I'm not gonna hate it because the music in the film is actually really good. So let's kind of dig into this. So this movie starts with and continues to have throughout tons and tons of exposition. Largely, the exposition is done by way of voiceovers in this inner monologue. It's constant throughout the film. This film actually starts with Virginia Madsen speaking to camera and telling kind of a quick history of what this universe is and what's going on. She plays the Emperor's daughter, Irulan. She's hardly in this film at all, at least in the final cut. She is a very important part of the story. She's a very important part of the novel, and they pretty much cut her entirely out. Madsen says she was signed for 3 films when she did this. She was very young at the time. I think she was in her early 20s. You see her in this beginning. You see her basically standing in the room at the end, and that's all that you see of her, which is really unfortunate. I'm so glad that Denis Villeneuve brought the character of Irulan back with a great actress in Florence Pugh, so I'm looking forward to seeing that this weekend. But here we have this exposition. Then you have this opening scene where the guild navigators come and speak to the Emperor, and you get more exposition, where the Emperor is basically just explaining to the navigators what's going on, what his plans are. You know, it's one of these, let me tell you about my evil plan things, and just kind of goes through so that by the time you get to really the first real scene in the movie on Caladan, you're somewhat in the way of caught up. By the way, Herbert was really annoyed at David Lynch for putting the navigator in this film. In the books, you don't see the navigators until the second, maybe even the third book. You do not, you only hear of the navigators. You don't see them in the first one. So to put that navigator up front, not exactly fitting the description in the book, was one of the things that really kind of irked Frank Herbert about it. But now we get to kind of the beginning of the movie proper, which is with Paul Atreides, played by Kyle MacLachlan. The cast in general is just absolutely ridiculous. So you have, we've already seen Virginia Madsen, who was a relative unknown at the time. We've already seen Jose Ferrer, who definitely was not. Ferrer was, he was a big get for this film. You know, he very famously played Cyrano de Bergerac in 1950. He was in the 1952 version of Moulin Rouge playing Toulouse-Lautrec. He was in the Caine Mutiny. He was in The Strike. He was in just a ton of movies. And, you know, he was a big get for this production. And then you get into Kyle MacLachlan. This was his first film. First time he was ever on screen. Somebody had seen him in a play and brought him to the attention of Raffaella De Laurentiis. And she went to see him and she brought him to the attention of her father and David Lynch. And that's how he wound up in the film. Lynch did want a fresh face and he thought that MacLachlan was the guy. I'm not sure he couldn't have done better. Kyle MacLachlan seems to have one expression on his face the entire film, kind of this pained confusion. Maybe in the better edits and the longer edits, he's given a little bit more to do. We also see as Leto Atreides, Jürgen Prochnow, a German actor who was very well known at this time for Das Boot, the German submarine movie that came out in 1981. Younger fans, people my age and a little younger, may remember him from Beverly Hills Cop 2, where he was one of the big baddies in that film. Also in Beverly Hills Cop 2 was Dean Stockwell, who plays Dr. Yui in this film. You also have Francesca Annis, who is a very well-known British actress, had done a lot of films, had won a BAFTA for a TV series that she did in the UK in the 70s. Jumping in, we got a pretty well-known cast here. We've got Patrick Stewart, who plays Gurney Halleck. He was perhaps not as well-known to especially American audiences at the time. He had been in Excalibur a few years earlier, but he was mainly known as a British stage actor. Obviously, a couple years after this, but 3 years after this, he would be cast as Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek, and then, you know, all bets are off with Patrick Stewart, but he's really great in this film. You have Richard Jordan, who was a well-known actor at the time, especially in sci-fi for Logan's Run, which was 76. Then rounding out the Atreides cast, you have Freddie Jones, another at the time well-known British actor. So, you know, this is a pretty stellar cast in this throughout, and we'll get into the, you know, the Harkonnens and the Fremens and stuff later, but you start to see this cast building, and it's a shame they really didn't get a lot to do. The pacing in this movie is not great at all. It's really terrible. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the edit and the multiple edits that this film had. But we seem to me, at least you spend so much time on Caladan, and then you get to Arrakis, and it seems to really be, everything seems to really be rushed. So they spent a lot of time doing setup. Makes more sense in the grand scheme of things if you consider the fact that they were looking at doing three movies. Maybe it makes a little bit more sense, and it's kind of the same thing that Star Wars has going on. You have all the setup in the beginning of Star Wars with Luke on Tatooine and all that stuff. And then by the time you get to the Death Star, things really start kicking along. This is paced pretty similarly, but it's a lot choppier. They obviously did not have Marshall Lucas editing their film. Maybe they should have. So after a long last, well, let's jump back a little bit. Let's just talk about this movie from a production standpoint, a production design standpoint. I think personally the production design on this film is absolutely amazing. I think I said that before. The production designer on this film was Tony Masters, who had done 2001 A Space Odyssey. He had done Papillon. He did The Deep. He did Taipan. I mean, all beautiful films. And the production design on this is absolutely exquisite. The palaces on Caladan, the palace on Arrakis and Arrakeen, just the whole city of Arrakeen, the way that the sieges are laid out, all the weapons, just everything is just really, really amazing. The other thing that I'm kind of on the fence about is the design of like the special effects and things. Now, obviously, looking at the 1984 special effects in 2024 can be a little rough, but these effects were considered absolutely revolutionary at the time. And I think a lot of them still hold up, especially the sandworms. The worms themselves were puppets, obviously, but so the problem with using miniatures with sand and water is that sand and water, they behave like they do at scale, regardless of what you're pushing through it. So you see this a lot in like those old World War II movies where you see like these model ships, which are basically going through a water tank, but the water doesn't look right because forms droplets, but the drops are huge compared to the scale of whatever the model is. You have the same kind of problem with sand. If you're trying to run a miniature through regular sand, the grains of sand are going to look like boulders next to the model. So they actually came up with micro sand. It's microscopic glass balloons. The stuff was actually really dangerous, so everybody had to wear respirators when they were filming this stuff. And that's what they used. And if you watch the sand effects, when the worms are coming up, You'll see it's very billowy and very cloudy. And there's no way they could have done that on a miniature with regular sand. This is the special sand that, or these, this micro sand that they used. in order to make it look like real sand at scale. It's absolutely incredible. The other thing that they did was they filmed it in slow motion, and that gives the idea of that these things are bigger, because things that are large tend to not look quick. Think about like a plane flying over, you know, it looks like it's even landing on a runway. It looks like it's going really, really slow because it's so huge, but it's really doing, you know, 180 miles an hour. Same kind of thing goes on here with the sandworms. It's almost invisible. Like you really can't even see it other than the one scene where the sandworm is eating the crawler and then the crawler explodes. Because of the slow motion, there's a bit of a delay. I'm sure when they were filming it, it was like right on the, you know, it looked almost instantaneous. But when you're watching it in the playback in slow motion, it looks like a little bit of a delay. Stuff like the ships were obviously composited in, and there's, you know, the compositing, let's be straight, the compositing wasn't great. You know, the lighting on the model ships is very different than the lighting in the backgrounds. You know, but those are all very typical. It has a very early 80s, late 70s feel to it. If you look like another movie, like something like Outland, it kind of feels the same way. Not everybody had the kind of effects that Lucasfilm had with, you know, the Star Wars films. Not everybody had access to Industrial Light and Magic. You know, they were the cream of the crop in those days, but not everybody could use them. Give you Star Trek V as an example. But in the large scale, the production design, the art design, the VFX, and the special effects, they're all really top-notch, especially for the time. And I think they oddly hold up throughout this. The personal shields, those were very weird. That was an artistic choice that they made. They wanted people to be able to see the shields and understand what they did. It's probably not the greatest real effect, but other than that, I think all the effects are, for its time, were really, really fantastic. Also, I just want to point out that the depiction of the Harkonnens, or as you know, the new films say it, the Harkonnens, is really over the top. I mean, these guys are all dialed up to 11 with no questions asked, especially Kenneth MacMillan playing Baron Harkonnen. I happen to think he's fantastic in it. That character needs to be, for that film, that character needs to be over the top. And he definitely is. I think he completely sells the insanity and the psychopathy of Baron Harkonnen. You know, the Raban character doesn't really do a lot. Sting as Fade, he's also over the top a bit. I just think these guys are great. You have to acknowledge there was a lot of pushback and even more so today about the depiction of the Harkonnens, and it's kind of a homophobic indicator. There's this definite homoeroticism going on with them, and the fact that, you know, there's practically a rape scene in it, the fact that the Baron kind of gets his kicks in very peculiar ways with young boys, it's problematic in 2024. Honestly, it was a bit problematic back in the 80s. There was a lot of pushback on it. And I don't recall that really being that out front in the book. It was an artistic choice, probably wasn't the best one to make, but Kenneth MacMillan's portrayal of Baron Harkonnen, I think, is really kind of spot on. He's a lot more interesting a character than Jose Ferrer, who seems to really be walking through this thing, or Kyle MacLachlan, who just seems to be way, way over his head. You know, I mentioned before, he's really stiff. He seems to have one expression. There's not a lot of emoting from him. He has zero chemistry with Sean Young. Which is weird because she is an actor who has chemistry with her co-stars. You know, you see her in things like Stripes or No Way Out or Blade Runner with Harrison Ford. I mean, she is a very charismatic actress at this point, and she does have a lot of chemistry with her male co-stars. I'm not feeling anything with these two. It's very stilted. The language in this film is very elevated and very kind of stuffy and formal. And I think some of the actors probably struggled a little bit with it because it's not the way real people talk. That could be part of it. There's a lot of pausing. Some of it could just be the editing. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. All in all, the film's a good film. It's worth a watch if you're a Dune completist. If you get through Dune 2, I wouldn't watch, if you've never seen it, I wouldn't see it before you see Dune 2, because there will be some spoilers in it. But once you're done with that, I would definitely go through it, take the time to watch it. It's on HBO, I think. It's definitely worth the watch, if nothing, to see a throwback and a different interpretation of the story. Obviously, I'm going to recommend that you read the book, because the book is the best version of the story. So once they were done with shooting, Lynch put this film together and went to edit it with Anthony Gibbs as editor. The original rough cut was about 4 hours. Lynch's cut was about 3 hours. The studio, Universal, the financiers, the producers, everybody wanted a 2-hour cut, somewhere around 2 hours. And so they went in and they chopped this film up, getting it down to the theatrical cut is 137 minutes. They cut a lot of it out. They chopped a lot up. They added, this is when they brought everybody in and they did all this ADR and they added all these whispering voiceovers. They had Virginia Madsen come in and do the intro to the film.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
This is kind of the film we wound up with. David Lynch was not happy with any of that. And for years, he refused to even talk about it in interviews. Never did a director's cut. A few years ago, oddly, he was interviewing with Inland Empire and said that he wouldn't mind taking a look at the footage and seeing if it was worth doing a cut, because it's been a long time. So who knows? The film had a couple of different television edits. It had a remaster and a 4K release. The television edits were really horrible. There was a lot of repeating scenes. In some cases, they took out the opening monologue by Virginia Madsen and just replaced it with words on cards and production art. David Lynch refused to have his name even put on that. So you'll see, if you ever get to see the TV cut, the director is credited as Alan Smithy, which is something that directors do when they don't want their name on a film. That's a common name that will be replaced. And that's more than just changing the name. That's saying, no, this is so bad, I don't even want anything to do with it. So, but the film was, the film did really poorly. As we said, it had a $40, $45 million budget. It made $30 million in its theatrical run. It opened second behind Beverly Hills Cop, but it fell pretty quickly. Roger Ebert gave it a 1-star. He hated the movie, especially some of the acting and some of the language. Gene Siskel also hated the movie. He called out on Siskel and Ebert. He also called out the homophobia with the portrayal of the Harkonnens. The film's got a 36 on Rotten Tomatoes, a 41 on Metacritic. I think those numbers are kind of harsh. I think the movie's better than that. But it was, it did not do well. It kind of brought a cult following. This thing, in the late 80s, early 90s, this thing was on TV all the time. It was on, you know, it was a regular on pay cable. I watched this movie a lot. A lot of people watch this movie a lot. And it's developed a bit of a cult following, to the point where a lot of, you know, people now are a lot more favorable towards the movie than they were back in the day. There was a miniseries in 2000 on Sci-Fi that did, they did it over the course of 4 or 5 episodes, and then they actually had a sequel where they did Dune Messiah. This film, David Lynch had started working on a sequel. He kind of abandoned it early on. There was a guy who wrote a book last year who found the scripts in a library and, you know, started going through them. It's a very big departure from Dune Messiah. Denis Villeneuve is apparently writing his third movie, which is going to be an adaptation of Dune Messiah. And he said he's out after that. He's not looking at going any further than that. So that's Dune, 1984. I hope you guys really take, if you haven't seen it, you take an opportunity to see it. Go see Dune Part 2. If you haven't seen the first one, go see the first one. Go see and do Part 2. I think this film is going to be a monster. The first film ran into, you know, an issue with the whole COVID thing, and Warner decided to release it on a day date where they put it out on HBO Max at the same day that it opened in theaters. And so it wound up doing, you know, pretty poorly. You know, grossed $434 million on a $110 million budget, or $160 million budget, I think. $165 million budget. But there's a lot more buzz for this one. And I think part of it, you know, I think while the early streaming release hurt the first movie, I think it probably helps the second movie, because I think I got a lot more people to watch the film than would have seen it if it was only a theatrical release. Going to see something, paying $12 to go see something is one thing, but you know, sitting in your living room is something else. And I think a lot of people took a chance on the movie and wound up really liking it that maybe would not have seen it had it been in the theaters. And obviously it would have wound up in streaming anyway. But, you know, I think there was a bit of an event around the release of that on Max. And so I think it did benefit from that. And I think bringing those people in will benefit this film a lot better. I mean, the buzz on this thing is absolutely ridiculous. So hopefully you're going to go see it this weekend. I'm going to go see it this weekend. And after you watch it, I would really suggest that you go back and you watch the 1984 version when you've got a free afternoon, because it's really a fun watch. So that's it for that. So let's go to the random number generator. And we are going to see a film in 1990. All right. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, here we come. I don't know. I'll have to go through the films and see what we've got. But that's it. Thank you for listening. And go see Dune Part 2. And then go watch Dune 1984. We'll check you later.